Well, good morning, guys. Is this going to work if I walk around?
Because
I can't stand still. In fact, I've got two things in my hand. I'll probably fall down now because I can't do that very well either. You guys, thank you for being here. This is amazing. It's so great to see all of you. You know, it's interesting. I get the chance to speak at a lot of these types of events, homeschooling conferences all over the country. And I don't get that chance to do it like right here at home very often. So this is really, really awesome and special for me. You guys, come home. That idea of coming home. I love the theme this year. And I've honestly had so many different thoughts as I've tried to consider what would be helpful to talk about this morning. I mean, we could talk about the importance of family. And then, why, you know, we homeschool because we want to be together more. We want to have that time with our family. And that's an important topic. We can talk about the importance of not allowing the government to mandate and control what we decide to teach and how we prepare our children for the world. We can talk about the opportunity to teach other things. And there's a lot that we could discuss. But today, I was telling my wife, I said, you know, I want to put a Nephi spin on it. So today, you guys, you get the Nephi spin, okay? Let me start with the story. Now, I have to explain this story because some of you guys have heard these types of stories before, but some of you have not. When I was a young man, I knew this other young man who was just an absolute terror to everyone around him. He did everything wrong. My kids have heard lots and lots of stories about this young man. And I have to be really careful. His name was Nephi, but it totally wasn't me. And so you have to understand that this was a kid I don't know anymore. He's gone, hopefully, from the world. Hopefully he's been killed somewhere, because he did lots and lots of terrible things. And this is a story about a boy named Nephi. So you guys, once upon a time, there's a boy named Nephi. He grew up in, let's just say, a place called Moab, Utah. I grew up there too, but it totally wasn't me. So Nephi loved to go out with his friends. But when he was like 16, 17, He loved driving. He had this little pickup truck. Anybody know what a Chevy Love is? L-U-V. A little tiny Chevy Love. I get some shaking heads. It was the absolute smallest, craziest pickup truck, but he thought it was really, really cool. It had no exhaust pipe, so everywhere he went, it was just incredibly loud. In fact, one day he got a ticket for driving it around because he was speeding, and he said, the cop said, I'm not going to give you a ticket for speeding, but you're going to get a ticket for a loud muffler. He loved to go out with his friends every weekend. Friday night, they would run to a place called City Market. It's a little store there in Moab, Utah. They would get donuts and chocolate milk, because donuts and chocolate milk could be dinner, breakfast, and lunch. And so they'd get a big box of donuts and a bunch of chocolate milk, and they'd go out somewhere camping. They would just take a sleeping bag. They'd go throw it out somewhere, start a fire, do crazy things, and have a great, enjoyable time. So one day, this boy named Nephi and his friends went out to Ken's Lake. It's a little lake near his house. And he took the Chevy Love, and he took it on this crazy road. I mean, it was like four-wheeling. Moab is great for four-wheeling. This was a crazy road. They had to go up this sheer face. It was probably 7 or 8 feet, almost straight vertical, and just kind of slowly crawl up it. But they were trying to get to a specific place that they'd seen before that was behind Ken's Lake. And they went through the creek, and they did all these things, and they got up there. And they laid out their sleeping bags, and they started a fire. And then they played Capture the Flag for a couple of hours and just had a great time. Well, a little bit later in the night, they're sitting there looking at the fire, getting a little bit bored. Some people are getting tired. Now, I don't think it was the boy named Nephi's idea, but it might have been. He looks up, and he sees an old dead tree. And he thinks to himself, that's a really dry, dead old tree. I wonder what would happen if we lit it on fire. And this isn't the tree, but it's a pretty good depiction of what the tree looked like. And it was right next to their camp. And so he's voiced the opinion that maybe they should light that tree on fire. And of course, his friends are like, no, 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 no. Actually, they weren't. They were like, yeah, let's do it. And so they took a little bit of the fire, they went underneath, and they put it underneath the base of this and lit it on fire. Now, in the beginning, it was cool. It started small. And it was just slowly kind of burning up the base of the tree. And oh, that's so cool. And the flames were kind of licking out, and they were different colors, and it was just really, really cool looking. Then the next phase occurred, which was, oh, that's getting a little bit bigger than we thought it was going to be. What should we do about this? And so then began the, what do we do? And so they started throwing dirt. They didn't have, like, a lot of water or anything. They threw the chocolate milk on it, of course. They threw some dirt on it. Nothing. It continued to grow. Then came the next phase of the experience. Suddenly, this tree turned into a raging inferno. I mean, flames were shooting 20 and 30 feet into the air. I mean, it was an enormous, enormous fire. And so they were freaking out at this point. What do we do? What do we do? They were pulling stuff away, making sure there was no other trees nearby, and this thing was just blazing into the air. Now, it would be great if that was the end of the story, but it's not. So, Nephi turns around and looks behind him, and what they had done is they had taken the truck up on this little plateau, and right behind it was this sheer wall of red rock, which was really, really beautiful in the light. Well, he looked back, and for like miles, the whole red rock was lit up with the light coming off of the flame from this tree. And so now they're like, oh crap, like everybody could see this giant, giant fire. And so now they're really freaking out. What do we do? What do we do? What do we do? And then it got worse. They looked down towards the lake, and out they could see a road back towards town. And coming down the road, they see the fire trucks, the lights of the fire trucks coming, and the police. And there's like 12 responders coming out to the lake. And now they really know that they're in trouble. Like they are freaking out. So this boy named Nephi is just like, what are we going to do? Should we try to get away? There's no way to get away. Like, we're stuck on this rock. And what should we just like run into the woods? Maybe they can't find us. They're totally freaking out. And he's like, what should we do? He's talking to him. And he's like, guys, what should we do? And he turns around, and there's nobody behind him. And so he looks around, and he's like, what's going on? And he looks back, and all of his friends, except for one, had crawled into their sleeping bags and put the sleeping bag over their head and were totally pretending that they had been asleep the whole time while Nephi's standing out there on the cliff trying to figure out what they're going to do. So he and his friend are like, well, there's nothing we can do. So they just sat down, they watched the beautiful fire burn the tree, and they watched the police and the fire trucks make their way all the way up past the lake, make their way up the road. And he's like, we're in trouble. I'm going to jail. This is the end of my life. And so they're sitting there waiting, and then they saw the fire trucks get to that straight vertical wall and stop. And they sat there and they watched them kind of get out of their trucks, talk to each other, and they just kind of milled around, and then they got back in their trucks, and they drove back to town. And so, this boy named Nephi, which totally wasn't me, by the way, didn't go to jail that day. But guys, I tell this story, first of all, because I was a knucklehead, and I totally made bad decisions. But the other reason is that we as a society, and as we look into the future of the economy, as we look at what's happening in education and other aspects, we're on a little bit of this, we're in this time period, which I would say is that early phase of the burning fire. We see things happening, and it's like, oh, that's interesting. Like, what is that going to do? How's that going to change us? What are we going to do to try to address that? It's not a raging inferno yet, I would say. But I think a lot of us can look out into the future and see things like, how are we going to deal with that? How are we going to prepare? And so today what I'd like to talk about is some of those things that we're going to be seeing, and how we can maybe prepare ourselves and our families for some of that. And what I really want you to take out of this is to understand and recognize how we collectively, as a homeschool community, are uniquely able to prepare for this if we'll be willing to make some changes and do so. Okay? And I just realized I'm supposed to be carrying this other microphone around with me too, and they totally missed a lot of that. So hopefully, now I'm really going to fall down. I got three things in my hand. Okay, So how did we get here? I'm going to very quickly go through this slide. Probably most of you know this already. Think about pre-industrial revolution. Our economy was very, very much small businesses. If you went into a village back prior to the steam industrial revolution, you would find a butcher, a baker, candlestick maker, right? So we would have small businesses, small farms. People worked together as families to produce. And the education system was the same. The education system was very much small, home-centered. A lot of times the entire education system was you read from the Bible at night with your family and you learned to read. That was what we considered to be the education system. Well, 1700s, 1800s, along comes the steam and electrical industrial revolution. What that did was it completely changed. It took the butcher and the baker and the candlestick maker, and it put the butcher in a large factory, you know, cutting up meat. The candlestick maker went to the candlestick factory, and it started to consolidate these small businesses into large operations, which, by the way, was a huge, huge blessing for us as an economy and for us as a society. We are very blessed to have what we have now because of that industrial revolution. There were a lot of benefits. But on the negative side, if you think about it, it also pulled dad and then later on mom out of the home to go to work, to go work at the factory. We weren't together in these small units anymore. And that had some negative impact, which I think years and years, hundreds of years later, we see a lot of those, the results of that. But also the education system. We have to go back to the education system. And you guys know this already, but we had to change the way we were educating because for factory workers, we needed them to have a basic level of education in order to function well within the factory. They had to be able to read instruction. They had to be able to do basic math. They had to have at least something to be able to follow along and do the things we needed. And remember, at this time, what did we get paid for in that era of time? It wasn't because we were smart or did anything. We got paid because we had skill sets. We went into the factories, we learned skills, we ran machines, and we were paid for those skill sets. Well, we did that for another 100 years. The school system started to look very much like a factory, right? We put people in rows, we had bells to tell them when to start and finish, we had lunch breaks, we had an authoritarian figure, a teacher, stand in the front, give them assignments. They were expected to be quiet and follow along. That was kind of the education system we developed, which worked very, very well for that period of time to develop factory workers. Then along comes computing. So a lot of us in this room went through the computing revolution. That's where we transitioned from before we got paid for skill sets. In the last, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, we have really been paid because we had knowledge. I remember very well coming out I did mechanical engineering, coming out of school, getting a job, and I got paid because I knew specific things about engineering that other people didn't know. And so that was what we were paid to do. We were paid to know things, knowledge accumulation. And so the school system that was developed continued to function relatively well. It could teach us knowledge. How to do basic math, how to do advanced math, how to do, and at that time, professional schools started to flourish where we had these certifications to prove that you had the knowledge in order to accomplish the jobs that you were put into. Well, you guys, now we're into what I call the fourth industrial revolution. We're up here. And in this fourth industrial revolution, we're talking about things like artificial intelligence. We're talking about robotics. We're talking about biotech and 3D printing and new ways of making materials, all of these things that are happening now that you guys are growing up in. And it is completely, completely different than what was happening in the 90s. Let's talk about a couple of these things. So by now, most of you guys know a lot about AI, right? How many of you guys use AI on a weekly basis? Raise your hand. Okay, what about on a daily basis? Okay, so much daily basis. What about a monthly basis? How many's never ever used AI one single time yet? Hey, we got a fair number. Awesome. Hey, that's all right. That's totally fine. You guys, I've been talking about AI for like 7 or 8 years. And here's what's happening. Here's what's been happening. So we've gone through an era. This was actually, this is Jensen Huang down there in the corner. He gave this talk last week. at the largest tech conference in the world. Jensen Huang is the president of the company that makes the chips that, like the computer chips that AI is going to be built on. He talked about kind of the evolution of AI. So we went through this initial perception AI, which we were doing like speech recognition and things like that. What most of us are familiar with is what we call generative AI. So you go into ChatGPT, you tell it, hey, I want you to be a marketer and help me start a business or help me market my business. What would you do? And you type in these queries, and then the AI, using a large database that they've been trained on, would give you responses back. Well, generative AI is really, really good for replacing things like marketing. It's good for replacing things like data analysis. And there's a lot of other things that it's been coming along and replacing. It's interesting, you guys. We've had an AI lawyer for about 15 years. And by the way, AI's been around since like 1956. We just never had the computing power to actually make it work until the last 10 years. It's been around a really, really long time. But we've had AI lawyers for a long time. We have AI working in the medical field already. We have AI replacing engineers. We have AI doing all kinds of things, and replacing jobs and replacing people all the way along the way. That's all very interesting. But what's happening now is this next one that's called agent or agentic AI. So agent AI is completely different from the AI that we have been introduced to and that we're experienced with. And let me just try to explain it on like the best possible way that I can. Up until now, if I needed something from artificial intelligence, I went in and I told it, I gave it prompts, I gave it queries, I kind of guided it to what I needed it to do. I need you to give me a 10-minute video about this particular thing, and I want it to be in this type of format, and I want these things. And then AI would be very competent, by the way, in going out and producing a 10-minute video on that stuff. Well, that's generative AI. The next evolution is agent AI. What agent AI means is, by the way, you guys, last week Facebook just announced they are not going to hire any more software engineers this year, because they're going to use agent AI to do all their software development. 2 weeks ago, Salesforce announced that they are not going to hire any developers ever again. They're going to turn all of that over to AI. Because what agent AI allows them to do is, I can sit down and I have this agent AI. It's a system built upon the data. All I have to do is I have to tell the, let's go back to that video creation. I will tell my agent AI, you are my marketing manager. I would like you to grow our sales by 50% in the next year. You have $10,000 of the budget to do it. Enter. And that's all you do. And then the agent AI goes out and looks at your business, evaluates businesses like you, evaluates all the things that are out there, and it starts creating content for you. It puts together a marketing plan for you. It doesn't just put the plan together. It starts to act upon the plan. It starts to create the marketing. You give it access to your Facebook, and it starts putting stuff on Facebook. It decides how often to post stuff on Facebook. It decides when an ad's working and when it's not. And if it's not working, it'll pull it down and put another one up. It decides what the voice of the company should be. It decides what colors it should do things in. It does all of it. And all you had to do was tell it, you're my marketing manager, and here's my business, and this is what I want you to accomplish. That is the next evolution of what AI is going to be doing. So, there are going to be some changes coming, right? There are definitely going to be. In fact, right now I'm working with a company to develop some software, and they came to me last week and they said, Nephi, you may want to just wait 6 months to start this project, because if you do, you can probably have an AI do it for like a 20th of the cost of what it's going to cost you to do with us. I was like, wow, 6 months? They said, yeah, maybe sooner, if you'll just wait just a little bit. So this stuff is like, it's here. Remember that burning tree? Like, it's getting to the point where it's like, oh crap, what do we do? Like, how are we going to deal with this? If you guys haven't seen this, this is Optimus. This is Tesla's robots that they're putting out. They're AI-based. They're fully functional. They actually did a gala a few months ago where they brought all these robots in and they brought people together, this really big deal. And the robots served everybody drinks and they cleaned up everything and they took care of all of the physical stuff. And so this is an area that's also going to be changing what we do. Okay, so you guys, I'm bringing us to this point, and I know a lot of you know all of this stuff already, and it's probably no news to you. But here's what I see for us as educators and for you guys as kids. You're kind of at this point where you're looking into the future, and my kids, so I have a daughter who's leaving home this year. She's going to go off into the world, and she's like, "Dad, I don't know what to do. What do I do? I hear you talk all the time about AI. I hear you talk about, you know, you took a cab that was completely remote controlled called Waymo. I hear that you," like, she hears all these things and she says, "Dad, I just don't know what to do." And so in a very real sense, our kids are growing up in this world where we don't know what the jobs will be. I can 100% tell you we probably won't have very many software developers. I can 100% tell you that we probably won't need as many lawyers as we have in the past. We won't need as many doctors as we have in the past. Now, I'm not saying that that stuff's going to go away completely, but I am saying we are going to need significantly fewer of them. It's gotten so bad in the law profession. I don't know if you guys have been following this, but there are many lawyers that go to school. They take on a couple $100,000 worth of debt. They come out of law school, and they're getting jobs for like $40,000 because they're just not needed as like they were before. They're not able to find jobs, or they find very low paying jobs with all of this debt. It's gotten so bad that a lot of the lawyers are actually suing their law schools. Now that's ironic, right? The lawyers are suing their law school because the law schools know we don't need any more lawyers, but for the sake of making money, they continue to put out more lawyers. The world you're growing up in, you guys, is very, very different. And we don't really know what's going to happen. We know that 30 years from now, 20 years from now perhaps, it's going to be very, very different. What we don't know is this transition period. And that's why it's so hard. And I understand when young people come to me and say, "I don't know what to do. I'm a little anxious. I really don't understand how to proceed in this world." Because for most of us adults, when we came out of high school, it was pretty obvious. If you wanted to be successful, if you went to college and got a degree and learned something and had some knowledge and skills, then there's a good chance you were going to have some success. That's not the world that your kids are growing up in. All right, let me just break this. Like, that's enough serious stuff. Let's get a story. So when I was growing up, this is a van that was very similar to what we had. Actually, ours was, I think, green. This is called a conversion van. In the back of this van, there is a bed. And so when I grew up in a family with five kids, my parents would sit up front, and we'd go on these long trips together in the back of the van. Now, I had four brothers and one sister. And my brothers and I were just angels all the time. Oh, three brothers. Excuse me. There's four boys, three brothers plus me. Thank you, Zoe. She's pointing out, "Dad, you're wrong. Your math is really bad." So the four of us boys, we were, so you guys, this may come as a surprise, but in the 80s, we didn't really wear seatbelts. So what we would do instead on these long road trips is we would go into the back on the bed, and we would just wrestle like crazy. Like, we would just beat the crap out of each other in the back of the van. I remember times where my older brother, who was much stronger than me, he would grab me and he would slam me against the side of the van. And my dad would like try to control it, because the whole van would rock. And he would like, "You guys knock it off," you know, and he'd get control again. And they'd slam us against the other side and he would screech. And so back and forth all the time, we were running down these roads. Now, because I never wore a seatbelt, I don't think I ever put a seatbelt on until I was probably like 18 or 19. And even after then, I still didn't continue to wear seatbelts. And even today, don't tell my wife, I don't think she's in here, I don't always wear my seatbelt because I just didn't have that habit. And so it would be very easy for me to stand up in front of my kids and say, "You know what, you guys, seatbelts are stupid. I never wear a seatbelt, and I'm totally fine. I never died. I'm here. I never even got slammed into the windshield very hard." right? Like I could totally say that. And that's a valid experience. That is my experience. But what we call that is survivor bias. Survivor bias means just because Nephi didn't die not wearing a seatbelt didn't mean a lot of people didn't die wearing seatbelts or not wearing seatbelts, right? So people did die, but because they're not here to tell us about it, they can't be like, yeah, please wear a seatbelt. You only get knuckleheads like me that say, oh yeah, don't wear a seatbelt. I never wear a seatbelt. I'm totally fine. Anyway, so with that survivor bias, we have that same thing in the education world. In the public school system, they look at it and they say, look, we've been doing it for 200 years this way. We've been grading people on math and reading and science for 200 years. I think we've got this figured out. Look, everybody's okay. Everyone's done just fine in the world. We've continued to move forward. But you guys, the reality is that is survivor bias. And sometimes in our homeschool, we do the same thing. We say, well, reading and writing are really important and learning basic mathematics and gaining knowledge. I want my kid to have a bunch of knowledge. They need to know their multiplication tables. They need to know all this knowledge because that's what we've always done and that's what the education should look like and it has worked forever. So it must be okay. But you guys, please don't be offended by this, okay? I don't mean to offend, and I'm not saying, I'm not standing up here and saying, don't teach your kids basic math and science and reading. What I am saying is that if you only teach basic science and math and reading, your kids are going to be woefully unprepared for the world that they're going into. Knowledge is not going to prepare them for a world where we no longer get paid for knowledge. Nobody, even right now, nobody is going to get paid because they know something. Knowledge is way too cheap. It's way too easy to accumulate. There is so much data in this world, and AI can just honestly do it better. If I need to know something, it's going to know it much quicker and more efficiently than I do. Now, there's tons and tons and tons of problems around this, and I see some of you guys like, yeah, but wait a minute. What about the bias in the AI? What about all these things? I understand that, and I know that, but I do believe that those things are going to get worked out. But the point of today is about education. We cannot have survivor bias. It is not 1995. And if we continue to educate like it's 1995, our kids cannot be prepared for what's coming. It's 2025 and we have to change. We have to evolve. We have to evaluate what we're doing and what we're trying to prepare our kids for. Specifically, how do you educate somebody for a world where we don't know what it looks like? Right? Because in the past, we knew. We knew that there were going to be lawyers, so we needed to train lawyers. We knew there were going to be doctors. We needed more doctors. We knew that there were going to be electricians, so we would do vocational schools and have electricians. That is not known anymore. And so how do we prepare our kids to be ready for a world where we just don't know what it's going to look like? And so for the remainder of my time, which I don't – let's see. Yeah, I got some time. I've not told too many stories yet. Let me talk about a few things that I think. Now, this is the Nephi twist. This is the Nephi perspective. You guys have to figure out for yourselves what you think that looks like. But let me give you a few things that I think about. Number one, I'm going to go to this side. A few years ago, my son Keller, he was really small, and he was at that cruising stage. You know that stage where you just start walking, you start pulling yourselves up on things. And he would walk all around our basement in Knoxville, Tennessee. And it was so fun to be with him down there. But one of the problems we had is we had this giant wood-burning fireplace. And so the fireplace, when we got it really rip-roaring hot, it would be glowing red. And by the way, guys, I love wood-based fire. Like, it's just so warm and comforting. It's my favorite thing. And so even now, we use a wood-burning stove at home. But we loved to get that thing roaring hot, and it would heat the whole house, which was awesome until Keller started cruising. Because as soon as Keller started cruising, now we had this little toddler, and I know at some point he's going to reach up and touch that stove. And so one day I'm down there, there's a fire in the stove, I'm really worried about him, he pulls himself up on the brick over there, and he's like, I could see him contemplating whether he should touch it or not. And so I grab him and I sit with him, and I'm like, Keller, it's hot. It's hot. Don't touch it. It's hot. Owie. Hot, hot, hot. And over repetitively, I taught him, the fireplace is hot. It's really, really hot. The stove, don't touch the stove. And finally, he's like, hot. And I'm like, yes, it's hot. Hot. Okay, you got it? Yeah. Like, I thought he had it. So I leave. He does just fine that day. A couple days later, there's Keller. I'm downstairs. He's cruising. He goes over to the fireplace and he pulls himself up on the fireplace, up on the brick. And I just watch him and he reaches his hand up. Now you guys think he's going to touch the stove. He doesn't. He actually reaches his hand up and he goes, hot. I was like, hey, that's awesome. He totally listened. I was like, yeah, that's a good job, Dad. Then I was like, oh crap, because there was no fire in the fireplace. It wasn't hot. It wasn't hot at all. So I had taught my son Keller this skill set that don't touch this device because it's hot. I taught a skill set, but that skill set wasn't always true and it wasn't always helpful or appropriate. It was just a skill set. Don't touch this thing. And so for the rest of his life, maybe he would never touch that again because he thought it was hot. What I should have taught Keller was a principle. The principle is that fire is hot. Now, why would it be important to teach a principle? Because if I taught Keller that fire was hot, then he would know that there's fire inside of the stove. The stove is hot. Don't touch the stove. There's fire there. Then, when we go camping, we're out around the fire. I don't have to sit with Keller again and try to be like, okay, also, this is hot, and try to teach him that. And then the next time there's a fire somewhere else, I'm burning a tree down, I don't have to teach Keller, like, this is hot too. Like, if I teach him the principle that fire is hot, I just got to do it one time. And that can be applied over and over and over into different things. So you guys, as we teach our kids, oftentimes we are teaching skill sets, which is totally fine. Skill sets are somewhat important, but just recognize that skill sets expire. But principles don't. And so if I'm teaching my kid, let's just take entrepreneurship because I love entrepreneurship. If I'm teaching my kids, hey, this is how you do a Facebook ad, right? We want to get people into your business, so we're going to advertise on Facebook. I don't start by teaching them how to do Facebook ads. The principle I want to teach them is, hey, how do you tell a good story? And so I teach them how to tell a good story. Then they can take a good story and use that in their Facebook ads. And then in the future, when Facebook's no longer a thing, and you know, we're getting to that point, right, where a lot of people aren't on Facebook, they're on TikTok now, they're on other places. When Facebook's no longer a thing, they still know how to tell a good story. And so they can still do that thing. They can still be successful in whatever it is because I teach principles, not skill sets. Now, I know that's hard, right? It's much easier to say, do this skill set, work on your math, but we have to break it down. We have to do a better job of teaching principles, things that will be true regardless of what's going to be happening in the future. All right, this is definitely me. I don't know if it's anybody else. Learning's hard, right? Anybody else out there? Is it just me? Am I the only one? No, we got a couple people. Okay. You guys, learning is hard, and that's just a reality. And oftentimes, we spend a whole bunch of our time trying to get our kids to learn some specific thing. How many battles have we had, right? How many times have we gone round and round and round trying to get them to focus? Man, I just want you to write better. So you got to write. You got to do this, right? Or I just want you to be good at math. But you guys, let's come back. I know we've all heard inspire, not require, right? And we all think, oh man, on my best day, I'm inspiring. And we all hope to do that. But here's the point. One of the reasons we want to inspire and not require, requiring people to learn something is just a knowledge acquisition transaction. What I mean by that is they are just learning some skill set or some knowledge, which, remember, is not really valuable in the future. Now, it's harder, but if you can teach your kids to learn, that may be one of the number one things that they're going to need in a future where we don't know what it looks like. Right now, people change jobs every 2.5 years. The average is 2.5 years. People change careers, meaning they go from accountant to like physician's assistant every 7 years. That is only going to accelerate. As we go on and we find out, oh no, no one's hiring software developers anymore. Well, all of those software developers have to do something. They're going to have to learn really, really quickly to do something else. The ability to pivot, the ability to like, okay, that's not a thing anymore. What am I going to go learn? So software developers, you don't know how to do, you're not going to do software development anymore. You better learn how to use AI to develop software, because we still need people doing some of that. But there's a new skill set. There's a new group of things that they have to learn. So those transitions are going to be so, so, so fast. Our kids have to be flexible and malleable. And so if we spend all our time requiring them to learn some specific knowledge set, you've got to know when Abraham Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address, instead of spending the time helping them learn how to learn the things that are important, the things that they love, the things that they have passion for. You guys, we've got to spend more time on that side. And I know it's hard. Believe me, I don't know exactly how to do this. But teaching how to learn may be the very best thing you can possibly do for your kids. All right, I love this one. Let me check my time. Oh God, we got plenty of time. I'll tell another story. Okay, so in science, any scientists in here? Any like people that love science? So in science, we love to put lines on things. It makes us feel really comfortable and happy. Because if we can put a line to it, we think that we understand it. And so in this data set, we've got these beautiful, beautiful lines. And then we've got these two dots out here, kind of sticking out in the middle of nowhere. Now, as a scientist, oftentimes what we do, we hate those dots because it makes it seem like we don't know what we're doing. And so we try to figure out reasons that maybe those dots are there. So we're like, oh yeah, the measurement equipment wasn't working, or it wasn't set up correctly, or, you know, in medical stuff, that person smokes, and so they're just an outlier. We have these outliers, and what we try to do is we try to push them out because we love average. We love normal. Right? Like that's our whole thing. There's a story about fighter pilots. So in the 50s and 60s, you know, in World War II and World War I, we were really, really good in the air. England was maybe the top in the world, but eventually as America entered World War II and shortly thereafter, we were the kings of the air. Like we had our kill ratio. So the number of planes we put down compared to how many planes of our planes went down, it was like 5-1. We were dominant in the air. In the 50s and 60s, we started to lose that. So in the Korean War and other wars at that time period, our dominance started to decrease. And so it was a big deal in the military to try to figure out what's going on. Why have things changed? And so they started to do an analysis, and they figured out that cockpits in the planes were designed back in like the 20s and 30s. And so they were measuring people in the 20s and 30s. Well, for those of you who don't know, we have grown as a society. Like our people are taller and bigger now than they ever have been in the past. So as people got bigger, they didn't fit the cockpit very well. And so the reason they were having these challenges was because they weren't able to reach the controls and do the things that they had done when the cockpit was designed for a smaller person. So the Air Force went through this giant, multi-hundred million dollar, analysis to figure out what size should we make the cockpits. And so they took like 2,000 of their fighter pilots, and they did all of these measurements. They measured the length of their upper arm and their lower arm and their torso and the circumference. They did all of these measurements, and they put in together these really, really complex models to figure out the average fighter pilot. Right? Sounds like a really good idea. And they redesigned the cockpits around the average fighter pilot, thinking this is going to be the answer to our problem. If we design around the average fighter pilot, everyone's going to be able to do it well. Well, they made the transition. They put all the money into it. They converted all the cockpits over, and they watched, and nothing changed. There was no improvement, nothing at all. And so there was one guy involved in the project. He came back and he said, "Well, I wonder." So he grabbed a couple of pilots and he measured the sizes of all of their stuff, the length of their arm and their torso and everything. And they found that not a single pilot that they measured was even close to average. They would have a little bit longer torso than the average. Maybe their arm length was the same, but their torso would be longer. Or maybe the circumference would be, there would be something different. And so they found out, you guys, that when we try to apply these scientific tactics or skill sets to people, to humans, defining something as average is really good when you're making like bottles. It's really, really awful when you're making humans. It just doesn't apply. Where there is no average. There is no average when it comes to humans. And that's our physical aspects. That's our mental aspects. That's our emotional, everything. There is no normal. And yet as a society, we are so stuck on the normal. We want to be normal. We want to be average. We want to apply these straight lines. So what they did in the Air Force is they made everything adjustable. They just made adjustable seats, adjustable controls, and converted all the cockpits again and saw our dominance in the air go back up. Because nobody is average. And you guys, our kids, and I can't say this strongly enough, our kids are not average. They have outliers. I have some kids that do certain things that just, to me, it's like, oh my goodness, I don't know what to do with these kids. They're like, why are you thinking? Like, why can't you think the way, be normal? But no, they're not. They're not. We're all weird, you guys. Now we're homeschoolers. We're extra weird, but we're all weird. We're all outliers. We all have differences. And so we have to stop trying to conform to the norm. You guys, nothing great has ever happened on the norm. All of the big things that have happened in the world, all of the things that have leapt us forward have come from outliers. Do you think somebody like Steve Jobs, who started Apple, was a normal guy? He wore the same exact shirt every single day of his life. He had like six of them, but they were all black turtlenecks, and that's all he wore. That's not normal. That's weird. But he created one of the greatest companies we have. Do you think Abraham Lincoln was normal? The guy wanted to get rid of the slaves, and he wanted to tear the country up to do it, and he was totally willing to go about doing it that way. That's not normal. That's weird. But he changed the way our country sees things. You guys, everything great happens in the outliers, and all the other stuff happens in the norm. We've got to steer into the outliers. So when your kid's weird and he's doing strange things, don't tamp it down. Figure out why that is and figure out what great things he can do with that. I have some kids that are so loud, you guys. They're just so loud. They're just so loud. But that's a superpower. I don't have that superpower. When I get into groups of people, if I'm not standing in front of people talking, I'm super quiet in the corner. And some of my kids aren't that way. And it drives me crazy. And I'm like, you gotta conform. You gotta be normal. But no, that's their superpower. We've got to steer into the superpowers. All the great stuff happens in the outliers. You guys, I'll just spend a second on this. We've got to fail more. We have to fail more. I cannot say this strongly enough, and normally I would spend a lot of time on this. The only way to improve, the only way to get better, and think about this, remember, we're preparing kids for a world where we don't know what it's going to be. Imagine sending your kid to school. They're going to go off to college in 5 years or however long it is. They're going to put their heart and soul into becoming the very best software developer that they possibly can. And then a year later, they're going to come out of school and find that there are no jobs for software developers. Now, this is just an example, right? If we don't help our kids fail and be resilient and be able to pick themselves up and be like, oh, that's okay. What's next? Then they are going to really, really struggle in this world. We have to help our kids fail more. The only way we can help our kids fail more is by putting them into situations and places where they can fail. They're probably not going to fail doing textbooks on our tables. Now, they might have little, like, I don't understand this failures, but there's not going to be like, I put my heart and my soul into doing this, and it just didn't work out the way I wanted to. That probably isn't going to happen that way. We've got to get them into different situations. We've got to get them out of the house. We've got to get them doing things. You guys want your kids to fail? Come talk to me about entrepreneurship. I will help them fail. I'll get them to start a business, and it will absolutely totally fail, but it'll be the most spectacular and wonderful and awesome failure of their lives.
Get them to do things that they possibly fail in, and when they do, pick them up and move forward. All right. Oh, you guys, resilience. Everyone knows the story of Sisyphus, right? So he had to push the boulder up the hill, and he just did it over and over every single day, and it got really tiresome at the end of the day, but every time he pushed the boulder to the top, it came back down, and he had to keep doing that. You guys, resilience. I'm working right now with an individual. We started a company together, and this person had a really awesome idea. They're brilliant. They had a way to solve a problem that nobody else has solved before. It's, you know, for people that grind their teeth at night, she created this device that prevents them from grinding their teeth in a way that nobody's ever done before and completely stops them from grinding their teeth. It's awesome. But this particular person has very little resilience. And it's been really, really difficult to work with her as a co-founder because every little thing throws her off. We'll have a call and she'll be like, well, I had the sniffles this week, so I didn't get anything done. Or, oh, I went into work and I had an allergy, so I didn't get anything done. And it's like, there's just no resilience. It's really hard. You guys, as I talk to people that employ people, one of their number one problems is their employees just don't know how to be resilient. When hard things happen, they don't know what to do. There was a researcher back in the 50s who did this rat study, and some of you guys have probably seen this. They would take rats and they would put them into baths of water, and they would let them swim. And that they would let them swim until they drowned. And they found, now they actually didn't let them drown completely. So they would swim, 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 swim. Most rats would flounder and drown in about 2 to 3 minutes. They would be in there, they'd be just pawing away, and then they would just give up 2 to 3 minutes in. Right as those rats gave up and started to go under, the researchers grabbed them and pulled them out of the water. They would pull them out, they would give them a few minutes to sit on the sidelines, revive themselves. Now, they're still tired. They basically just drowned. They gave everything they could and then gave up and were going to drown. They pulled them out, they dried them off, they let them sit for a couple minutes and put them directly back into the water. Now, you would expect that they would, 2 to 3 minutes later, probably flounder again. But they didn't. They went on for 4 hours, 5 hours, 12 hours, 24 hours, 36 hours. 48 hours later, many of the rats were still going. After floundering after 2 to 3 minutes and drowning, when they put them back in, they went for sometimes multiple days. I think the record was 60-something hours that one of the rats just fought. A rat that had given up after 2 minutes swam for the 60-something hours afterwards. We want our kids to be resilient. All of us want our kids to be resilient. But what we know about resilience, more than maybe we ever have before, resilience only happens when there's hope. The rats were willing to continue fighting because they thought in their minds, someone's going to save me. Someone's going to reach in here eventually and pull me out. They just did it. Did you see them? They pulled me out. And so they would keep fighting much, much, much longer because they had hope that somebody would help them. Oftentimes we think, okay, we want to build resilience. And so we give them our kids these really hard things. They're like, just be resilient. Just do it. Just do that. You know, but just hard things without hope of success, without hope of a benefit, without hope of improving. If they don't understand what that endpoint is, there is no resilience built. They just give up. It's just hard. We have to connect hope with the battle. That's how you build real resilience. Teach your kids to be entrepreneurs, right? My wife's looking at me like, cut it off. You guys, there are so many things that we can be doing. Entrepreneurship is one of them. I don't know what your family is going to look like. I don't know how you are going to prepare your kids for what's coming. But recognize we don't know what's coming, and we have to change what we've been doing. We just have to start doing it differently. If you find that you're stressed and overwhelmed and you just give the kids the workbooks because that's what's easy, that's okay once in a while. But we have to step back and recognize it's not 1995, it's 2025. And if we don't change, then they will not be prepared. We are uniquely able to do this. Guess what? The school districts, the school systems can't do this. I think the Pocatello school districts right now are arguing about how to redraw lines because their enrollments have dropped. That's what their focus is on. Right? But we can focus on the important things. And I promise that if you'll take the time, step back, take the time to do this, your kids are going to be better prepared for that unknown world. Thank you.
He's dreamy, isn't he? Okay, adults, you got to get out of here and get back upstairs. That's where your classes are. Youth, stay here, and we're going to wait for them to leave, all the grown-ups, and then we're going to do some games. So, adult skedaddle. Thank you.